This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. It's been slightly more than 10 years now since the iconic Bursae 2.0 rally that took place on the 9th of July in 2011. Now, authorities fired tear gas and water cannons. Close to 1,700 people were arrested. But it did not break the spirits of those who were protesting, those who marched on nonetheless. Today, in light of its 10th year anniversary, I'm joined via Zoom by two activists, Nalini Elumalai and Ivy Josiah, both of whom were some of the important figures behind the Bursae 2.0 rally. In fact, Ivy wasn't in Malaysia at the time. She was in New York and with the global Bursae people. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are you doing today?
Great. Great. Nice to walk down memory lane. Yes.
10 years.
Yeah.
I know. I don't know whether I can remember correctly or not. You know, we all are getting old.
I mean, Ivy, you're even wearing your Bursae t-shirt. I mean, our listeners won't be able to see.
But that's... I must have the samangar, as you said. Yeah.
All right. Let's get right into it. There have been Bursae rallies even before 2011, right? The 2007 protest comes to mind. But what was particularly significant about the 2011 protests?
So, I didn't join the rally in 2007. I wasn't around, actually. So, I went back to hometown. There was something else was happening. So, I wasn't able to join the 2007 rally. But 2011 is my first Bursae rally, actually. So it is already a very special because that's my first rally. And also it's very, not really special, but it's very tense because before the rally, you know, six PSM activists, was also my comrades, right, were arrested under the emergency ordinance. So there were so many things was going on at this, at that point of time, that we actually, I was in the role of, you know, organizing a vigil every night to demand the release of the EO6. There was something else was going on. So many people were arrested for wearing Bursae t-shirts. And then people for speaking out or distributing leaflets. But there were so many things was going on at that point of time. So, and I think the most important is, like, it's a very hype of activism in Malaysia as well, for all the activists. You know, we all are together and on the same page, and, you know, and a very high semangat, you know, at that point of time. So I think it's something that I will never forget in my life, because it's the vibrant civil society movement was, I can say it's a very hype of it. So that's why it's very special.
I think the significance of 2011 Bursae was the fact that it was being led by NGOs, by civil society, right? Mm-hmm. So 2007, that was the first Bursae that was organized by political parties. And so, like Nalini, all of us, we were not very involved. Some NGO activists were involved, but not civil society organizations. Individuals were involved, I think. So Bursae, the first Bursae in 2007 happened. We looked in wonder and wondered what it was all about. Then next thing we knew, we got... It was announced that Maria Chin is now going to be organizing Bursae 2.0 in 2011, and Ambika was going to be the leader. And it was a strategy to, it was a very interesting strategy and an important strategy that the electoral reform movement be led by civil society, but that doesn't mean the political parties do not get involved. They support it. So there was that turn there, you know. And you're absolutely right. 2011 was, I think, a very, very stressful but very exciting time for us.
So paint a picture for us. Remind us again what was happening exactly in our political landscape at the time to spark this protest, especially of this magnitude, Ivy.
The environment was that we were very, very, very disappointed with the ruling government at that time, right? the call for electoral reform, that we knew that almost every elections we went to, because we all were involved in elections in one way or another, either as a volunteer or helping, you know, a friend who was running, we knew that it wasn't clean, it wasn't fair. So we knew that in order to the call for clean and fair elections was something that touched everybody's lives. At the same time, there was the EO6. Nalini, perhaps you can throw some light in here. The EO6 was the group of PSM members were going around the country educating the public, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a campaign. It's Udala Bersarala BN. So basically calling for BN to, you know, Bersara. So it was like educational awareness campaign throughout the country. So eventually, we all will be joining Bersih Rally on the 9th of July. But then everything was, before even they begin, I was in the South team actually at that point of time. So never was allowed to do leafleting and so on and so forth. So, and many of the activists was arrested back then when they were distributing leaflets. And after that, of course, you know, there was an even more serious allegation against the PSM activists that they're waging war against Agum and so on and so forth for bringing all these colonial element communists and so on things. But on the 2nd of July, then the 6 was arrested under the EO6. But before that, they all were detained for 2 weeks. They were all remanded for 2 weeks for investigation and things like that. And then on 2nd of July, when they're supposed to release, they were actually, six of them were put under EO and then were brought to Bukit Aman. Then the campaign to release them started. So it's like an ongoing, at the same time the EO6 was going on, but the Bersih preparation was going on and people were arrested for, you know, wearing T-shirts and office of secretary of Bersih was raided. You know, so many things was going on. I remember we were in Swaram. Of course, we have a lot of things to do, but also like every day, we have to send out like urgent appeal to alert people. There are people being arrested in Perak for wearing T-shirt. There are people being arrested in Johor for distributing leaflet.
There was a heightened activity prior to the actual rally. There was the arrest of the PSM6, the EO6. There was arrest of various individuals, public, who were wearing T-shirts. All of it was building up to this big rally that we're going to have, right? Mm-hmm. So the publicity for the July 9th rally was very strong. I mean, it was already becoming very infectious all around Malaysia, including cities around the world. People were talking about this yellow T-shirt. And as Nalini said that, you know, people wearing T-shirts were getting arrested. And then the arrest of the EO6 also heightened the activism because people were very angry as to why this, you know, six people were arrested under the emergency ordinance. And so people were very excited because at the end of the day, we knew we wanted to make a dent in elections. We wanted to make sure there's fair elections so that everybody gets a chance. All of us were involved in some kind of election campaign whenever, you know, there were several elections. And we knew it was very unfair, not an even playing ground. Opposition members especially didn't get airtime. No one knew what was happening. So I think a lot of people were very, very angered by the fact that my vote doesn't count. And I want to make my vote count. I want to make sure there are clean and fair elections and make sure the electoral roll is proper and so on. So the fact that the government was arresting people left, right and center also heightened the anger and the excitement, and of course the leadership of Ambiga and Maria was also important, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly there was this leader who's saying, we demand clean and fair elections. So July 9th was, everybody was looking forward to July 9th.
Now, Nalini, take me back to the days and weeks leading up to it. What was going on behind the scenes?
Well, I try to remember. Basically, this is like 10 years ago. But I was looking through some of the articles and the urgent appeal that we sent from Swaram. It's very interesting because if you see some of the events that took place, for example, on the 27th June of 2011, the media reported that UMNO youth members had gathered late night and threatened to burn down the PKR office and ask PKR to withdraw support for the Bersih 2.0 rally. That was one of the things was going on. And actually, there is a news about it when I was looking for it. So that is one event. And then on 28 June, like about 40 PSM supporters were subject to, you know, verbal abuse and everything outside the Kepala Batas police station when they were arrested and they were detained. And then 29 of June, for example, Bersih 2.0 press conference in Penang was disrupted by several members from the Suara Anak-Anak Mama Pulau Pinang. So, you know, there was so much of abuses and the press conference was disrupted. And then Bersih 2.0 secretary office raided, for example. They seized all the material related to Bersih 2.0 rally, like T-shirts, leaflets, and they also actually arrested seven staff organizing illegal rally actually. So it was conducted without a warrant and they all were called for investigation. I remember all of us were there in the police station, in PJ police station. I don't know if you remember, Ivy, but I think we all were there until they all released. You know, I think they were detained for almost like eight or nine hours and then only they were all released after that. So I think these are some of the events that I remember actually.
I think there was obviously constant planning going on. I remember being in the Bersih office and even I was not allowed to go into a room where Ambiga and Maria and the security were there to discuss what kind of plans, what kind of alternative plans are they going to have, plan A, plan B. What was interesting for me and what was very exciting was that every time there was a raid in Bersih office, all the civil society members will just turn up at the office.
Yep.
Everybody will turn up. The kind of solidarity that we had was very, very strong. And yes, you're right. There's some information that not everybody knew. Even though there was a civil society, there was a steering committee, only the steering committee knew what was going on. So people like me were like the outside. It's only later on for Bersih 3 and 4 and 5 that I had a more intimate knowledge of what was going on behind the, you know, in terms of planning. But Bersih 2, I was very much not an outsider, but the outsiders giving support and making sure that we support Ambiga, we support Maria, and especially the organizers because they were, you know, they were our colleagues, you know. So we really didn't know. We didn't know what was the actual plan. And of course, then the big announcement came that Bersih rally mustn't go on and X number of people are banned from going to KL.
I'm one
is
of
this
them.
When you, let's talk about it, right? Because leading up to the protest, the cops placed a restriction order on 91 individuals, including organizers of the Bersih 2 rally, NGOs and whatnot. Mm. They were all put on the list, 91 people. You were on the list too, right, Nalini?
Yeah.
Tell me about it. How did they... When was this exactly, and what was the reason they gave for this restriction notice?
So I think it came out on the 7th of July. I still remember that. So basically, they want to avoid, this order is actually to avoid any activity that can disrupt public order. So basically, we all are, you know, some people who can disrupt the public order. So we were not allowed to get into Kuala Lumpur, actually, to KL. But honestly, I saw the list and then we like, okay, let's do let's do our work. It didn't bother me at all, to be honest. And for me, I was very sure that we all are going for the rally, and we're going to because Swaram was in charge of the urgent arrest team on the day of the rally. You know, so I was leading the entire Swaram team, so I had a huge responsibility at that point of time. So I didn't have other things to think about, and everyone who was in the list is we just actually checking each other is everyone is okay. But other than that, everyone was there on the 9th of July, you know, on the day of the rally. As far as I remember, most of the people who listed that I know was there on and we already actually, I mean, I was in KL anyway, so.
But this is one of the strategies, right? And all the Bersih that have participated, they say don't go to Kuala Lumpur. I mean, in Bersih in 2011, they banned you from going to Kuala Lumpur. But guess what we will do? We will check into hotels the night before.
Yeah.
That was the strategy that everybody now knows.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're really anything huge year. But that's what even in 2011, that's what happened. The leaders checked themselves into a hotel. And so we would go down to town before, because we didn't know whether they would block the public transport and so on. So we get there before the event, the night before the event. But by the way, I fled the country. No, I remember being in such a dilemma because I knew, I mean, of course, I was, you know, Ambiga and Maria are good friends and I was in touch with them. And I know that there was a lot of pressure on both, on Ambiga and Maria. And I had to tell them that I'm actually leaving because I had a UN meeting, a CEDAW training. I had a UN meeting in New York and I have to go because I was one of the trainers. So then Maria hooked me up with the Global Bursae people in New York because, of course, she knew that there were many, many Malaysians all over the world, including the US, who are organizing rallies on the 9th of July in their respective countries. Right. So I, with a heavy heart, I left for New York. But while I was in New York, I kept track of what was happening in Malaysia. And as you well know, on the 9th of July, the rally did take place. And so did a lot of, there was a lot of chaos too, because, you know, the police attacked the rally goers.
Yeah. So let's get into that, right? On the day itself is the 9th of July, 2011. Nalini, despite the restriction order, like we talked about, you guys still took it to the streets, right? Weren't you afraid?
No. No.
Oh. You were not afraid. Look, I think for me, every time I go to a protest, of course, now I'm not so afraid the way I used to. Every time we go to a protest, you're always afraid. Afraid meaning, you know, you don't want to get arrested. You don't want to spend a night in a lockup. But isn't courage overcoming the fear, right? Mm. Not realizing that even though there is this sort of, oh gosh, something can happen, right? But you do it anyway because there's solidarity and you overcome the fear. So I don't know. I can't so bravely say I did not feel any fear.
Yeah. Nalini, do you genuinely not feel afraid when it comes to this? Or do you feel some worry or fear, but it's more about, you know, being together with that many people for a common cause that keeps you going?
I think, honestly, Dash, I wasn't afraid. You know, I think for me, facing police or huge amount of police, it's never been something that I'm afraid of. I never afraid of police all my life. And I think that is not my major concern. My major concern was I was in the hotel room. And then we all were actually getting ready to go out. And I saw so many people was going out, actually, like ordinary people, that, you know, together with us. And they were all wearing Bursae T-shirt. We also were wearing Bursae T-shirt. And suddenly we saw so many police officers was coming into the hotel and then trying to, you know, arrest and take people away. And they did take some people away. But that was my only worry, that whether they will be, you know, beaten up, whether they're going to be, I don't know what's going to happen. That's my only worry. I didn't worry about myself at that point of time because I was very clear that I can handle, you know, the situation because of, you know, our experience and things like that. But, you know, I saw so many people, ordinary people, who might not have the same level of knowledge on how to deal with the police. I'm worried for them, to be honest. But for me, I never afraid to go out and attend the rally and to face the police and things like that. But the entire
I really believe Nalini, because it's from Nalini and the whole PSM lot that I learned how not to fear the police. They really taught me that the police station is a public institution and I have every right to be in front of the police station, to enter the police station. And from them, I learned whenever my friends got arrested, I would walk into a police station and ask them, where's my friend? So it was a slow process for me, but I got there. But thanks to activists like Nalini and Arul.
Yeah, it's not easy. I think for me, I believe to overcome your fear, I think you have to be there and then you experience that and you learn. And after that, I've seen how many, even my own friends, who don't have fear anymore to face, you know, the entire environment. The second Bursay rally after that, the in 2012, I saw so many of my friends say, no, I'm still going to go and I'm going to face this because this is my rights and I want to, you know, give my voice and that's it. So I think, but also, but also there will be some backlashes to some individuals, you know, who might not even turn up after that because of what they saw, the police brutality, the tear gas, the water cannons and things like that. But I'm still, I think, you know, although they can't be there on the street with us, but I think, the, you know, the spirit and the solidarity is still there. You know, nobody would come and tell us, like, you all deserve this. So I don't think that people from the same circle have told me that. So I think, you know, for me, it's just you face it and then you will, you know, there will be no more fear. So that's how I live my life all this time.
I think it was Ambika who, after Bursay 3, I remember her saying, patients no longer fear. So that was Bursay 2, which was July 2011. Yes. And then there was Bursay 3, which was in 2012, right? Mm-hmm. And Bursay 3, 2012 was also, you know, water cannons and so on. And you're absolutely right, Nalini. I think the Bursay, the T-shirts were also banned for Bursay 3. But when you get up in the morning, come out of your hotel and you see everyone wearing the T-shirts, you feel so proud. You feel so brave. You see, ordinary Malaysians can wear the T-shirt and are not afraid of arrest. And who are you as an activist, you know, leader? Who are you? And you're right. You worry about them. You stop worrying about yourself. You make sure that you are carrying out your duties. And because, you know, we were responsible for the security, the safety, and of course the arrest, making sure they're arrested, that they are, you know, that they are bailed out, right?
Yeah. On the show with me today are Nalini Elumalai and Ivy Josiah, activists who are some of the key figures during the Bursay 2.0 rally that happened 10 years ago. After the break, I'll be asking them how much they think our country has changed since the iconic protest. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dasharan Johan, and on the show with me today is Nalini Elumalai and Ivy Josiah, activists who were some of the figures involved during the Bursay 2.0 rally that happened 10 years ago, which is what we are reflecting on today. Nali, when did the attack by the authorities happen on the ground? Like, when did they start with the water cannons and the tear gases? And what was the immediate reaction on the streets at the point?
I think I was the team from Brickfields walking to Dataran Merdeka. You know, I think when I was in Dataran Merdeka, then we had this tear gas, if I'm not mistaken, and water cannon. I can see people running around. Of course, you know, everybody was in fear. And then everyone is actually checking and pulling each other to make sure safe, because police was basically very, very brutal, you know, and they will start arresting people because of the tear gas. You know, it's just, you cannot actually focus and think for a while, because you were like, literally, you were trying to save your life with like drinking water and putting salt and things like that. So I think it took a while for us to just, you know, for me to personally, I just sit there. Then the first thing I did was, I remember I saw people were running around. And then before the rally took place, we actually distributed, you know, our numbers, Swaram numbers, that people should text us when, you know, which police station they are bringing. So that is my responsibility. So I stood for a while, and then I call all my Swaram colleagues who was actually stationed in a different places. Like, there are in Pudu, and then there were people in Masjid Jame, you know, so everywhere. And then we just communicated, and then say, let's meet up in one of the LRT station nearest. We all gathered, and then we started actually distributing, you know, our contacts to whoever there. And then we say, let's focus on going to police station, and we station ourselves there. That is the most important thing. And then we communicated with the lawyers, and then they say people are being arrested, people are being taken away, and things like that. So I think at that point of time, in my mind, it's just what was going on. It's like, I need to be in the police station. I need to make sure that, you know, everybody is safe, whoever being arrested is safe. And I remember on that day, it's more than 1,000 people was actually arrested, and they all were in in Jinjiang, if I'm not mistaken, you know. And people like Ambiga and a few others was also arrested. If I'm not mistaken, Anwar was arrested as well. So there are so many people, you know, so, but we all just went there and then, and it was raining. After a while, it was raining as well. So, you know, there's too many things was going on, but I was very focused that I need to go to police station. So I think that is the main thing that's going on in my mind. So, you know, it's hard to, whoever was in close contact with us on the street at that point, I think we just was making sure that they all calm down, they don't run, you know, just sit and then just, you know, get some rest and then clear your mind, you know, and things like that. But, you know, eventually you cannot, because the whole point of the police reacting in such a way is they want to disperse you, but disperse you in a very unorganized way. You know, just also to show that we are not very organized, to show to the world that, you know, we are not organized crowd and so on and so forth. It was very well organized until police disrupted the entire event, you know. It was really, really organized. People were even, in fact, at that point of time, people were actually collecting rubbish, trashes all over the, and we keep reminding each other, don't throw rubbish, you know, please be clean. All sort of things was going on. And suddenly the police disrupted with the water cannon and tear gas. And, you know, so I think there were so many things was going on. But what I remember very clearly, like we all get together to do what Swaram supposed to do on the day, you know, get everyone out. And we were there and in police station for until the last person was released, actually. And then we all went back to office and then we slept at office for a couple of hours. And then we got up and then we were like checking news and things like that, you know. So that was our life for a couple of days, actually.
And in 2011, the people were running off. I mean, because they dispersed the crowd in a very brutal way, right, with the tear gas. And Dash, when you have tear gas in your eyes, I mean, I wasn't there on 2011, but I have experienced tear gas prior to that, under ISA protests. When you have tear gas in your eyes, you cannot think straight. You think you're going to die because you can't breathe. Everything is, you know, you can't think straight. So people were just running helter-skelter. But what is, again, interesting for me, was very heartwarming. And we must remember, my friends who were on the ground on 2011 told me later that when they ran to the hospital, when they ran to the people opened up and got them in. Come in. So that they can get away from the gas. So that always makes my hair stand on end.
Can you also share a little bit about what, at this moment, right, on July 9th, I mean, putting time zones aside, what was going on among Malaysians where you were at New York, right? You said at the time, was there a lot of concern among Malaysians in New York, or were they paying a lot of attention to what was going on in the country? Did you feel a lot of solidarity there as well?
As soon as I arrived in New York, I got in touch with the person in charge of the Bercy, New York. As soon as I arrived in New York, I got in touch with the person in charge of Bercy, New York, because by then Global Bercy was already formed and there was a city coordinator in all the cities, whether it's San Francisco or New York and so on. And I think at first, they were a little bit not so friendly because they were not sure who I was, because, and they were not sure whether, you know, who am I? You know, they don't know me. Am I a spy for the government and so on? But of course, I had to use Maria's name. I said, Maria gave me your name. I'm supposed to get in touch with you. I want to know what the plan is for 9th of July in New York. So so on the 9th of July, on a Saturday morning in New York, I got up early hours ironing my T-shirt. While I'm ironing my T-shirt, my friends in Malaysia were already in the police stations. I remember calling Maria on the phone, and she actually picked up the phone and she was laughing. She and Ambiga were laughing and said, "So bad, this police have arrested us." So they were in the police stations, right? So my morning is via Saturday, Malaysian time, Saturday night. So I walked to the Malaysian consulate. I knew that the Malaysians were all meeting there. And I remember, I was so early. My friend Vashla and I were in this UN meeting, so we went there early. There was no one around. Then suddenly I saw, you know, a group of 15 people walking towards us carrying a banner. And suddenly there were other people wearing 20 other people wearing yellow. So it started emerging from all corners of the street. And there was absolutely no fear because, again, we are in the US. Protests are allowed. I remember the policeman, a policeman approached me and said, please make sure that you do not stand in the pathway of people walking up and down because people are jogging up and down and so on. So he was making sure that we all were, you know, safe and sound. But what was sinister about the New York gathering is this. So by about, you know, within about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, there were already about 100 people all wearing yellow T-shirts. People gave speeches and all. But what was sinister was I could see there was one guy, probably somebody from the consulate, taking photographs of all of us. It's always, so I was telling my friend Bachelor, oh, must be special branch, must be special branch. I think a lot of Malaysians overseas also, especially students, always also had that fear, not from the police in America that they're going to turn, you know, water cannons on them, but whether or not their scholarships will be withdrawn. Even something as simple as my Malaysian friends in New York didn't want to join, those who are living in New York didn't want to join the protest because, like, what if I can't come to... come back to Malaysia? What if they ban me from coming back to Malaysia, right? So there is this constant fear, but, you know, people just overcome the fear. So it was very, very peaceful. And I was telling Nalini, I had to channel her because Nalini is very good at giving speeches and going, you know, saying, you know, Hidup Rakyat. I was saying, okay, I must do a Nalini here because I'm not ready for that kind of thing. I learned from Nalini. And I got up and made a speech and I went, Hidup Rakyat, you know, and so on. I was very peaceful, very calm, you know, almost a non-event. But what was interesting was mingling with all these Malaysians. I remember this elderly couple saying, oh, we came to visit my daughter and we decided, no, we'll go down and we'll make a homemade banner.
So now, like we said, you know, at the start, y'all made a joke about, you know, being 10 years older now since the 2011 rally. How do you reflect on these 10 years? I want to get both your takes on this. How much has our political landscape and also our country changed? And reflecting back on it and looking at our current political landscape, would you consider it a success?
Throughout the whole Bersih, whether it's from Bersih 2, 3, 4, and 5, and especially Bersih 4, which was an overnighter, you know, yes, we made sure that we went there on the 29th and remained there from 29th afternoon to the 30th midnight. We wanted to show that we are resolute, a word that Maria Chin used, we must show we are resolute. And then Bersih 5 was especially very stressful and very emotional for us because Maria was arrested. And we all had to take over. Whatever happened, we had to go down and carry on the rally. But what was happening was Bersih was building up the courage and the determination of Malaysians. You know, that the crowd was, the people were growing, the supporters were growing for electoral reform. Not necessarily for Bersih, but the issue is that we all wanted free and fair elections. And I believe that Bersih played a large role in encouraging Malaysians and getting Malaysians to think, you know what, let's try another government. Let's try another political party.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with her. Because what I see throughout this year, so I joined NGO in 2006 and I was very young at that time. I was only 23 years old. And then when we organized protests at that time, you know, you very hardly you get support from the public. And it's very hardly there will be a lot of people on the street, you know. Like I was doing anti-ISA campaign and things like that. There's always activists, it's always the same people. But I think Bersih really, as what Ivy say, it's a political awakening in Malaysia. It actually, you know, from 2007 onwards, from the first Bersih rally to, you know, until the last one, even now, it's a political awakening in Malaysia. People from my generation and maybe your generation, Dash, I think that it's something that we all learn that, you know, there's more than, you know, we cannot be selfish anymore. we have to do something about, you know, about this political situation in Malaysia. And I think one most important thing that I learned throughout this, maybe in the last 10 years, is like, and you know, initially it's only, you know, the civil society organization or people who have more civic awareness who will try to protect the civic space and freedom of expression and assembly in Malaysia. But, you know, Bersih, I think it's open up to every Malaysian to actually saying that you cannot take away the civic space from ourselves. You know, we're all going to protect this freedom. We're all going to protect this civic space and all the space, the democracy space that we have. It's no longer that only a couple of people want to protect and talk about it, but it's actually everyone in the country was talking about it, you know. So I think that is the most important reflection that I can see. Now people can talk about not just about election, but an election wasn't a very interesting topic before Bersih rallies, right? Nobody was interested in, like, you know, postal vote or electoral reform. Nobody was really care. But it became a very sensational issue because of all this education and rallies and so on and so forth. But even that, you know, people actually go beyond, you know, electoral discourse to something more than, you know, human rights discourse, you know, police brutality. And people had a lot of courage to come out and talk about, you know, torture and so many things. So that is something that I can see that, you know, it has contributed to a democracy movement in the country. So that's how I want to recollect the last 10 years, you know, of Bersih rallies.
I think the word movement is very important. Yeah. Bersih has built a movement on civil and political rights, right?
Yeah.
And you put it very nicely, Nalini. It all owned it. Every individual started owning this space.
Yeah.
And realized that we have a responsibility too.
Yeah.
We cannot just leave it to NGO leaders and political parties. We all have a role in it.
Yeah.
That's why even during elections, you find that a lot of citizens are monitoring. Following the ballot boxes. So everybody got involved. Everybody got involved in monitoring and making sure there was a free and fair elections. So yeah, there was definitely, we have a stronger civil society, but more importantly, stronger people's movement.
Yeah,
I have to second that, because Bersih rallies, as the early ones especially, were my political awakening as well. I mean, I was always, you know, interested in current affairs and all that, but to really, you know, understand, you know, what democracy is in Malaysia and the need to fight for it and the space and that we as the people, you know, can have power. I think my awakening came from the early Bersih rallies. I think 2011, I was 18. But just looking at the other side of it, right, Ivy, one of the criticisms I've heard dished out against Bersih, especially in recent, maybe the past few months or year or so, is that it has become a little bit soft after GE14, that many members of Bersih became too friendly with the elites, albeit elites from the other side, and also that there hasn't been much noise from Bersih in our current political climate, especially given that we are dealing with a health and economic crisis. People have wondered, you know, why hasn't Bersih sort of showed up again, that, you know, people haven't seen much organizing and mobilizing. How would you respond to this?
You're right. Right after Pakatan Harapan went into government, civil society was very busy working with the political elites, because these ministers, these deputy ministers, these MPs who are now holding, were the ruling government, were the same people who were walking with us and marching with us, you know, on the ground. So they were our friends. They were people we were familiar with. And so, to be fair, we were working with them closely to try and reform Malaysia. We were in many, many different committees. We were very near. We were trying to establish the police, independent police commission, change the laws for women. So we were very busy working with the ruling government, because doors suddenly opened, right? And then the Sheraton move took place. And yes, when the Sheraton move took place, there was this expectation for civil society to respond accordingly. Like, why aren't we protesting? This is a terrible thing that's happened. They've taken away our democracy. We can't have a backdoor government. And there were some protests, in Dasara Merdeka, but very few people turned up. I would say maybe about 200-300 people. The question is, why isn't Bursi organizing its huge big rallies? Mm-hmm. My response to it is that I think COVID has taken away a lot of our freedom of movement. Yeah. You know, Dash, personally, during COVID times, of course, I've gone down to protest. I've gone down to the police station to give support. My friends are arrested. I'm not afraid of getting arrested. I'm afraid of getting COVID. I don't want to get into a lockup or into a police station, especially because at that time I wasn't even vaccinated. So all of these things, you know, play heavily on us. And there's also a thinking that if we go down and protest, are we going to have a COVID surge? Are we then therefore going to be responsible for people ending up in hospitals and therefore burdening the hospital system, the you know, the medical system, the frontliners? So all of these things, you know, are being discussed in various different groups of civil society. What should we do? Why aren't we on the ground mobilizing people? I think COVID certainly has cramped our style, but despite that, there are still protests, right? Mm-hmm. I think there is this hesitation because they feel that Malaysians will actually be very, very angry if we do a huge big protest and endanger the lives of people.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think there are a few things. Before Pakatan Harapan and after Pakatan Harapan, I think the role of the civil society and Bursi have changed as well, right? From a pressure group to reaction to, but now, you know, as Ivy said, the door is open and everybody wants to do something to make sure that the government can, you know, fulfill the promises that they have promised during election. And one of the things, the responsibility of the civil society at that point of time in making sure or guiding through the government to implement all these policies and laws and everything that, you know, was promised and for betterment of the country. But, you know, I think what Ivy says, it's also my opinion, because when the COVID-19, you know, at the beginning of it, the Sheraton happened and then there was COVID. The only concern at that point of time, like how much that we can go on the street, like, you know, like when it's a public health crisis, it's not just happening in Malaysia, but it's a world global public health crisis is going on. So in our, in even in my own opinion, I was like, you know, how do you want to put people more in, you know, on danger? Do you, like how we can be a responsible civil society and how we can actually respond to it, you know, with more vibrant way, but then not put anyone in danger. I think the health system is that, like, how, you know, whether the people going to angry with the civil society or not, or Bursi or not, if they propose or they say that let's go for a rally. But eventually, after it was like, you know, the first wave is done and people, you know, were trying to do so many things as well. And then the next wave started immediately after that. So, you know, every action, everything that we want to do, it has been stopped because of we also have concern, you know, our own public, our own health and also public health as well, you know. And I think the moving forward, I think what we need to discuss, like post-COVID and post-MCO, like how we can actually, you know, making sure that civil society is playing more role to bringing more, you know, like people on the street or things like that, like how we can actually reactivate ourselves and the people, you know, who actually have been gone through so much in these 2 years. And now actually we can, you know, go and find that spirit again and vibrant society again. And now we can, you know, educate this entire Malaysians again.
I actually think it's already happening. Although we are not on the ground physically, and yet there are some brave souls who are still going out and, you know, and protesting, you know, maybe 30, 40 people, not, you know, 100,000, not 50,000, not even 30,000. I would say the most would be about 60 odd people, the young people did protest in front of Parliament. I think people are already organizing themselves through social media. The number of TikTok messages, poems, songs that are coming, emerging out, from especially from women, young women, a lot of messages by ordinary citizens saying that this is very unfair, the situation, you know, our government is being very, very unfair. I think that's already happening. Something is already happening among Malaysians, especially among young people. And perhaps we need to stop saying, why isn't Bursa doing anything?
Yeah.
Perhaps the question should be, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think I would rather that we look at ourselves and especially younger organizations and young people who have, there's so many young groups these days, and perhaps they are our new leaders,
yeah.
the young leaders.
Yeah. I think it's also how we can sustain the Black Flag movement on the social media, you know, and we need to sustain that because we can see like there are a lot of anger and everything was channeled, you know, through people posting about it and things like that. And I think we need to see how we can sustain this online movement as well, so that people who, you know, unable to express physically or on the street, they have another avenue to express themselves and show, you know, their anger or, you know, their opinion or anything. So I think we need to see how we can sustain this young people's initiative as well.
I see a beginning of Black t-shirts, maybe not yellow t-shirts, but Black t-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a beginning. Something's happening. No, something's happening among Malaysians where we're saying enough is enough.
On that wonderful note, ladies, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Bye, Nash. But we didn't tell you all the stories about what happened in Bursa 3, Bursa 4. Another time.
That was Nalini Elumalai and Ivy Josiah, activists who were some of the figures involved during the Bursa 2.0 rally that happened 10 years ago. So if you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcast from. I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.